Hello and welcome to the Hotchkiss & Wiley podcast series. My name is John Hossie and I'm joined today by David Green, Portfolio Manager on the Hotchkiss & Wiley Value Opportunities Fund. For those who may be new to Hotchkiss or to VO, David has 31 years of industry experience with the past 24 of those years here at the firm. Since the fund's Class I inception at the end of December 2002, David and the investment team have delivered over 300 basis points of excess annualized return relative to the Russell 3000 Value Index. With a continued revival of value as we turn the calendar into 2022, we believe we are still in the early innings of this movement. I'll delve further into this with David, but first, a few disclosures. This podcast is for general information only and should not be relied on for investment advice or recommendation of any particular security, strategy, or investment product. The portfolio manager's views and opinions expressed in this podcast are as of January 26, 2022. Such views are subject to change and may differ from others in the firm or the firm as a whole. The portfolio manager's comments include some estimated and/or forecasted views, which are believed to be based on reasonable assumptions within the bounds of current and historical information. However, there is no guarantee that any estimates, forecasts, or views will be realized. In the event of new information or changed circumstances, Hotchkiss & Wiley reserves the right to change its investment perspective and outlook. So, David, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure to be here.
So maybe we can have you start by providing our audience with an overview of how Value Opportunities differentiates itself from other offerings here at Hotchkiss & Wiley.
Sure. So I think the biggest difference with Value Opportunities from other offerings at Hotchkiss & Wiley, and quite frankly, most other offerings in the marketplace, is that, first of all, we're not limited in terms of our market cap. So you see there's large cap, there's mid cap, there's small cap. Those are very typical offerings in the marketplace. This is a go-anywhere product where we can really invest in any of the market caps. In addition, we're not limited to the U.S. It's our focus. It's where we tend to have the majority of our assets and investments. But if we find an interesting opportunity internationally in Canada, in the U.K., in France, Switzerland, we'll take advantage of that as well. And then finally, we do have the flexibility to go down into the capital structure. And by that, I mean, if we see a preferred stock that's especially attractive or a high yield bond that's fallen out of favor, that's got very excellent risk reward opportunities for us, we will take advantage of that as well. So this product really has the full ability to go where it thinks the best opportunities are. And then, like the rest of our firm, we have the benefit of the tremendous research platform that sits behind us and that fuels the engine behind this product.
So in addition to basically going outside of the U.S. as you see fit or going across the market cap spectrum, you also talk about special situations, which is actually pretty low in the portfolio now. Can you talk about how you view special situations, what those entail, and when you might deploy those?
Yeah, so we view the core of the portfolio as domestic equities. And that's always where the bulk of the portfolio has been invested. I expect that will always be the bulk of where the portfolio will always be invested. But there are times when we see attractive opportunities that aren't sort of in the what we call core bucket. And I'll give you some examples. International equities would be an example. So if we saw a really good opportunity in the UK, something better than anything we could get risk-adjusted on a risk-adjusted return here in the US, we would take advantage of that. If we saw a preferred stock that was especially attractive with very high yields and a low risk profile, we would take advantage of that. If we saw a convertible bond that was especially opportunistic, we would take advantage of that. Risk arbitrage. Now, that is usually a domestic equity, or oftentimes is. It's a company that is being acquired and has a contract. But there are times when risk arbitrage will be very attractive, and we put that into a special situations bucket. The best example of that I could give was during the financial crisis, when companies had merger agreements in hand, signed documents, and the market started to unravel, and there was this tremendous fear out there that the deals weren't going to close, but yet they had these signed contracts and literally binding contracts that in many cases the companies couldn't get out of even if they wanted to. And so at that point, risk arbitrage became a big piece of the portfolio, probably close to 20% at its peak or around there. Today, we have zero in risk arbitrage because that's really not an attractive area. When deals get announced today, the spreads tend to be very tight and there really isn't an opportunity there. In fact, we had a company, Triple S, which is a health insurer that we owned, There was a bid to acquire it last year. We sold the day of the bid, most of our stock, we sold all of it. It's out completely out at this point, but we sold almost all of it either the day or shortly thereafter the bid, because once the bid was announced, the spread was so low, it didn't make sense for us to stay in it. A very different situation than we saw in 2009 during the financial crisis. So special situations are something that we take advantage of what the market gives us, but we don't feel like we're forced in a certain way. It really is what the opportunity is at a certain period in time. If you look today, there's very little distress in the marketplace today, very little. The high yield market does not show signs of distress currently, so we have almost nothing, very little in that exposure there. Preferred market, no signs of distress there. And the risk arbitrage market, no signs of distress there. So really the only material place we found today, and again, I always say today because I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, but the only place today that we found that is sort of rife for special situations is international equities. And today we have about 16% of our portfolio in international equities. And that's probably, if you look over the last 4 or 5 years, that's probably around the middle of the pack. We've had more and we've had less, but it's a decent exposure to international equities. We don't do it from a macro perspective. We don't say, okay, wow, the UK market looks attractive. We do it from a bottoms up perspective like we do with all of our stocks. And we're fortunate that we have an international product and a global product. And so I see, and I'm also one of the portfolio managers on our international product, I see what opportunities there are internationally. And from a bottoms up perspective, if something makes sense and I think it's an excellent risk adjusted return, it gets put into the portfolio.
Now, in terms of valuation, the dispersion between value and growth continues to be quite wide, despite some pretty strong performance out of value over the past year. While value has closed the gap just a bit, there's still a long way to go. Can you talk about what you're seeing today?
Yeah, there definitely is a long way to go. If you look at different metrics, for example, if you look at trailing PE, the Russell 3000 value divided by the Russell 3000 growth, going back from 95 till today, we're in the lowest quintile today in terms of that, which means that the valuations are very optimum, if you will, for value. If you look at performance over the last 10-year period, I have a chart here that goes back to 1937 through November 2021. I have a 10-year and a 20-year rolling performance. On the 20-year, actually, value typically outperforms growth. It typically does. The last 20 years have been the worst 20-year period in that history. We're in the 100th percentile, and we're in the 96th percentile for the last 10 years. So you've had this huge outperformance of growth versus value, which has set up a situation now where, quite frankly, the spreads are very large between value and growth. And that's why when we talk about being in that, you know, lowest quintile, we think that's a very good time to be investing in value stocks.
So within that realm in value, are there particular areas of the market that you are seeing as being relatively inexpensive? For instance, energy is a fairly large weight in the portfolio. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit, or other sectors that you're gravitating toward at this point.
Yeah. So what's really interesting is, again, we don't target sectors. They're an outgrowth of what's happening at the individual stock level. So we build the portfolios up on the individual stock level based on the best risk-adjusted returns. Then from that, you get certain sectors which are overweight and certain sectors which are underweight. So if you look at our biggest exposure today is financials. Although our overweight to the Russell 3000 value in financials, we do have an overweight, but it's slight. It's maybe, looking at the chart, maybe we're around 300 or 400 basis points of an overweight relative to the Russell 3000 value. So it is our largest exposure. It's what we view as the cheapest part of the market today, but it's been more opportunistic in the past. And in the past, we've had a much bigger overweight. Our second biggest exposure and our biggest overweight is technology. And it's interesting, we found some technology companies that even in this market, we think are very mispriced. Ones that have dominant positions that are growing fast and that have very, very good businesses. One of the things that we do is we look at a few different metrics when we look at a stock. The first is valuation. What is it trading at on a price to normal earnings basis? But then we also look at certain risk factors. How good is the quality of the business? How good is the balance sheet? And how good is the governance? And we rank all three of those on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being best. So the best rank you could get would be a 1, 1, 1, a 3, and the worst rank you could get would be a 5, 5, 5, or 15. And so in general, with these technology holdings, they are amongst the best companies, the best businesses, highest quality that we own. Now, I will say that they tend to have a higher valuation on average than the rest of the portfolio. And in some cases, they're the highest valuation. And so that's the trade-off, is we're looking at both what is the valuation and then how good is the business quality. And then the next biggest overweight is energy. And energy is interesting because since 2014, we had essentially a crash in oil prices. And until recently, we haven't really seen any kind of rebound in those oil prices, a bit here and there. But what that's meant is, since we're sitting here in 2022, is we're going into our 8th year, essentially, of underinvestment. And during the pandemic, obviously, demand significantly came down, but it has rebounded quite robustly, actually, since then. But during the pandemic, the amount of capital invested in the ground by these energy companies really contracted. So you had lower CapEx going back to 2014, the pandemic hit, and then the oil and gas companies really cut back on their capital expenditures. So we think that you're going to experience a period where, if demand stays as robust as it has been and should continue to be, you get into a situation where potentially you end up getting short oil, at least for a period of time, because the capital has not been invested. And when you look at these stocks on our normal, which is $65 barrel of oil, they're cheap. And there's a good chance, actually, that that price of oil is higher for a period of time. And again, what's been, quite frankly, somewhat surprising to me is how strong the demand has been, even in the midst of this pandemic, from a demand perspective.
Yeah, the demand has been fairly strong. And these energy names are, especially the E&Ps, are really not putting more capital into pulling more oil out of the ground at this point. So they're just free cash flow generating monsters, aren't they?
They have been very disciplined at this point. And I think there's a lot of scars. And so they have been very disciplined. And if they take that cash and they buy back their stock or they pay out dividends, at this point, many of them have paid down so much debt they don't need to continue to pay down debt. Some still do. But you're right. They're using their capital to return that capital to shareholders or to pay off debt much more than they are to reinvest back into the ground. So they're generating quite a bit of free cash flow.
Got it. And you mentioned technology, which, again, is a big weight in the portfolio. Can you talk about some of the names that might not necessarily be viewed as value names, like a Microsoft or an Alphabet or even your top holding F5?
Yeah, I'll start out with Alphabet because it is in the Russell 1000 value. So it is, at least by that classification, considered a value stock. And I was actually just looking at it. Alphabet, Google has done extremely well. But the reason it's done extremely well over time is because the earnings are up so much. If you look at the 2023 estimates on Google, it's trading at 11.8 times enterprise value to EBITDA. That is not an expensive valuation by any means. So it's definitely towards the higher end, especially on PE, because they have a fantastic balance sheet. So on a PE basis, it's higher. But it's a dominant business. And we've started to see margins in that business expand. And this is a company that should have margins expand, but tends to spend a lot of money on a lot of things. And if they ever ran their business a little more efficiently, even a little bit, we think the earnings power could be even much higher than it is today. That's an example of a great business. It's trading at a decent valuation, but not excessive, and where we think there's opportunities to expand the margins. In the case of Microsoft, we bought our first shares of Microsoft probably around 10 years ago, and we've got some lots in the high 20s. The stock now is over $300 a share today. If you would have told me when we originally bought Microsoft that we would own it at $300 a share, I would have said, well, first of all, I don't think it's going to $300. And if it did, I don't think there's any chance we would own it. Here it is, one of our top positions. And the fact is that the business has just been so exceptional and the earnings power have been much greater than we originally thought. and they continue to exceed our expectations. And Azure, which is their cloud business, is quite promising in terms of what it can become. And there's really two players that are dominant in that market, which is Azure and Amazon with their AWS product. But it's a product that the market is totally embracing. It's a huge addressable market, and it's where the shift is going, is to the cloud. And Microsoft is one of the two dominant players there. But it's also the best business that we own. And when we look at the metrics that we look at, which is the quality of the business, the balance sheet, the governance, and the predictability, if you will, of those earnings coming through, it ends up getting a higher weight than strictly on valuation alone. So your ideal situation is you find a great business at a great valuation. That's the ideal situation. Most of the times, what you find in the market is great businesses at very high valuations, oftentimes excessive, which is why we don't own them, or poor businesses at low valuations. And so there's always a trade-off, and you're trying to find the situation where you can find a good opportunity, not sacrifice the quality of the business if you don't have to, but still have good valuation. F5 is a perfect example of that. F5 is an example of what I consider to be a very good business, not as good as Microsoft, not as good as Google, very few companies are, but still a very good business. They have 40% market share in their core market. And they're a company that sells software and hardware with, it's essentially a software product that helps apps run efficiently and securely. Their biggest product is essentially a load balancer. So if you log on to your bank app, let's say you bank at Chase and you go onto your Chase app and you log on to that, it will send it to the servers, probably either at the Chase, assuming let's call it, say at the Chase data center. But before it hits those servers, it's got to talk to a load balancer, decide which servers to go to. If everybody's opening their app at the same time, it's got to distribute them. It's got to optimize which servers it goes to. And so that's where F5 will come in, and it will be sort of like a traffic controller. But it's also the perfect place to put security and to make sure that there's no hackers trying to get in. And because if you get the security there, it's before it actually touches the server. And so it turns out that that's been a huge growth area for them. And when you lay on top of that the fact that applications are booming, and you know, all companies essentially have got applications now, we think this is a very, very large growth market for a long period of time. They've got very high renewal rates, extremely high. And we think that their top line could grow about 10% a year. But because there should be operating leverage and margin expansion over time, we think that their EPS should grow in excess of 20% a year. So a very good business. And it's trading as a software company at about 4x enterprise value to revenue, which is very low, quite frankly, for a software company. So we think this is an example of a good business at an attractive valuation, and that's why it's our top position.
Great, thanks. And I know you're a bottom-up investor, but I have to ask this question anyway. Since value tends to outperform in an inflationary environment, we should have tailwinds, so to speak. But are you concerned about the Fed's ability to rein in inflation without causing a recession? And does that have any impact on portfolio positioning?
Yeah, I am concerned, but I think that to the extent that the economy is strong, they will be inclined to raise rates. If they start to see weakness in the economy, my guess is that they will not raise rates as aggressively as people think. So the reason we're talking about rate increases right now is because the economy is so strong. And I think if the Fed starts to tighten too aggressively and we start to get into a recession or worry about a recession, that they'll slow that down. But yeah, I am concerned about it. It's why when you look at our holdings, one of the things we focus on is balance sheet, because if there is a slowdown, we want the companies to be able to withstand demand drops and bumps in the road to their business. I think about it a lot. It's one of the nice things about these technology companies is they tend to be more recession resistant. I talked about the overweights in the portfolio. We do have underweights to the other parts of the portfolio that are more recession resistant. Like we have a huge underweight in healthcare, a huge underweight in staples, a huge underweight in utilities. And that's because those parts of the market are highly valued, and people are putting a high valuation on sort of, well, if we do go into a recession. And when you look at what you have to pay, if you will, for that, I'll call it insurance, we think that cost is too high. And so are we worried about it? Sure, we're worried about everything and we think about it. But when you think about where the best opportunities are in the market today, they still are in the parts of the market that have sort of exposure to the economy.
And so just to be clear, overall portfolio risk is basically a function of the fundamental risk ratings of each individual stock in the portfolio then?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest risk mitigant would be valuation. So if you're, it's sort of like if you're climbing a ladder, you're always worried about falling, but if you're on the bottom rung, you just can't fall that far. And as you go higher and higher, you know, it's more risk. So that's the first kind of risk mitigant. And if you look at our portfolio today, our price to normal earnings is about 8.6 times versus 17.2 times for the Russell 3000 value. Our price to forward earnings, FY2, is 12 times versus 15.8 for the Russell 3000 value. And our price to book is 1.6 versus 2.4 for the Russell 3000 value. So the most important mitigant is valuation. But then on top of valuation, we have these risk scores, which is quality, balance sheet, and governance, which are also very, very important when building the portfolio.
Well, I think those factors are really coming into play. It's been a rough start to 2022, but your portfolio has held up relatively well versus most of the major indices so far. Is there anything as you look out through the end of 2022 that you basically think is going to be a headwind, tailwind, et cetera?
Well, interestingly enough, if oil prices do go up a lot from here, I think that the economies will feel that. Having said that, I think we'll be well positioned because of our exposure to energy. So that's one thing to think about. We do think about, you know, interest rates and how much they could go up. Now, we have a bit of an offset there because our banks should benefit from higher interest rates as they earn higher spreads on their deposits. Those are things that I think about. But I would also remind people, which is the news is always the news, and it seems all-consuming when you're listening to it at that moment. But over long periods of time, the U.S. economy has been a real engine for growth, and I wouldn't bet against it when you're looking out over long periods of time.
Well, that's for sure. And I think, you know, there's a lot to look forward to, and we'll see what the Fed has to say this afternoon. And with that, David, thank you for taking the time today.
Oh, sure. My pleasure. Thanks, John.
And we thank our audience for their interest in the Hotchkiss & Wiley Value Opportunities Fund. For further information, please visit www.hwcm.com or call us at 888-596-4926. Thank you.